But welcome to Woodbridge Community Hall. Thank you very much for coming this afternoon. This event has been organised by Brandeis Bookshop, and we're very pleased to have Victoria Hislop with us this afternoon. My name is Catherine Lana, and I'll be talking to Victoria for about 40 to 45 minutes, and we might show a few slides at the same time. And then there'll be the opportunity for your questions before we go to book signing. So we'll do that at the end. Now, this isn't quite the first event for Victoria for this new book. She started off her tour yesterday evening, but with a second. It's not her first visit to Suffolk either. She came to launch her last book, which was Carp Pistel from Greece. We're up to six books now. This is the sixth novel, and a couple of collections of short stories as well. But Suffolk, tell us why you enjoy coming back to Suffolk.
Well, hello everyone, thank you all for coming. I think it's a Suffolk show going on, so that's a pretty stiff competition, so I'm even more flattered to see so many of you. And to be sitting once again on this terrifyingly slightly impaired stool, which there was exactly the same stools, weren't they, when I came through?
I take them with me everywhere.
So I have to sit very still, but very inanimate. Yes, I've come, in fact, to Woodbridge a lot to see my mother, who's here today in the audience. He's at the Grove Court residential home, which is a wonderful place. I'm going to be putting my name down for it. And my sister, just as importantly, who's the reason that my mother is here, who's lived in Woodbridge for many years. So it's a place of kind of happy family memories. And of course, like everybody who lives in London, we have friends who live in Aldborough, that seems to be a sort of second home for lots of people who are friends of ours, so we come quite a lot. And it seems to be a county that sort of punches way above its weight culturally and aesthetically, and yet sort of doesn't have that kind of sort of she-she, I better not insult any other counties, that's what I call Sussex she-she. Suffolk is still very much separate from London. It has its own things going on, and quite often things happening in Ipswich with music, culture, that are the envy of London. So it's a wonderful county, and I envy you living here.
Well, we're very pleased to have you here, so thank you very much for coming. And it's quite a tour that you're going to be on as well, so we're very lucky to have you at the beginning of it, thank you. And we'll perhaps hear a little bit more about that later. But this, you started, your first book was obviously The Island, which we've all read and love. But this book has also got an island as its main location. So can you tell us a little bit about how this book came about in the first place?
Yeah, I think I'm quite lucky, because all the books I've written, I've had a moment of inspiration, or a moment when I've seen something, usually a place, which just grabs me in a way that I can't ignore. It makes my hair stand on end. It's a great feeling, and I've had it six times now. And if I don't have another one, then I won't be able to write another book. But I'll just show you. It looks like one of my happy holiday slides, but beware, they all get a bit darker than this. This is the Temple of Poseidon, which is just outside Athens, a few kilometres south on the Athens Riviera. Very beautiful temple on Cape Sunion. I don't think it shows up in this particular picture, but Byron came along one day and carved his name in stone. And of course, we all think Byron, which is a wonderful chap, was basically a vandal in my books. Anyway, I was taken by a Greek friend about a decade ago, so it's a long time ago. And I love the temple. I mean, I really do like Greek archaeology, and I'm getting to like it more and more as time goes on. But what really grabbed my interest was this strange, dark spit of land at the back of it. Which is actually an island. And of course I asked my Greek companion, I said, what's that island? You know, is it a famous one? Can we go there? And he very darkly said, no, we can't go there. It used to be a pr- prison for communists, and nobody lives there anymore. And for me, that was rather an electrifying discovery. There was a kind of essentially an equivalent of an Alcatraz or a Robben Island, not much more than 10 kilometres from the coast, and a very popular bit of coast. And from that moment on, I started reading up and finding out anything I could about Mykonissos, always hoping that one day I'd be able to get there. And it uncovered for me in my research basically the story of this kind of deeply polarised country that Greece was in the 30s, 40s, really right up to some extent up to now, not quite so much, but right through the 60s, 70s, into the 80s, still this kind of very strongly divided country. And I'll just show you one of the things I found. There were lots of black and white footage of Mykonissos as it had been in the 1940s, when, as my Greek friend had told me, the communists were sent there during the Civil War if they were captured. Mykonissos was always, because it was government run, and it was always euphemistically known as a place of correction, because the idea at that point was that if you were a communist, you had basically strayed off what was the correct path, and you needed to be brought back into the sort of the mainstream. Mm. And so people were sent there and lived this very regimented life in these rows of tents, and on an island where there was no water, there are no trees there, it's a very kind of savage, arid environment. So I got hold of everything I could about Mykonissos at that time. And then also discovered that there were women, or had been women, in prison there as well during the 1940s, actually end of the 40s, beginning of the 50s. And of course that piqued my interest even more, because as I've always done in my past books, my main protagonist is usually a woman. And it was when I realised that women were part of this communist civil war against the right, I knew that this was going to be a focus of my next book. And just a couple more pictures of women leading this sort of very difficult and physically challenging existence.
So Mykonissos was the inspiration for the book, but we don't start off in Mykonissos at the beginning, do we? So what is... Tell us a little bit about the plot of the book, which is quite substantial.
I'll do that without giving... Because my mother's actually reading it at the moment, and I don't want to give anything away. I'm sure, probably no, because the book's not officially out yet, probably no one, apart from Catherine, knows the kind of course of events and what happens at the end, so I'll try and do that no spoilers thing. So, having sort of filled my head and I suppose my passions to some extent with discovering this Civil War situation and how communists have been treated. I should, by the way, say I'm not a communist, but I felt very strongly that they were persecuted if they were captured, and in a way they were persecuted for many decades afterwards. So I never felt that had any justice surrounding it. But of course, having learned about the Civil War, I thought, why was there a Civil War? You know, how did that happen? Because even though we're quite a divided country at the moment, we're not going to have a Civil War. I know you're not. We're not going to pick up guns. I can really say, you know, we're British, we won't do that to each other. But why was there a Civil War in Greece? Well, it all stemmed almost without breath from the moment that the Second World War ended in Greece, when the Nazis left Greece at the end of
1944.
Oh, I keep feeling you're losing me, but so if anybody can't hear at the back, can they just throw up a hand? And I think we're all right now. So the Germans had occupied Greece in 1941, and for 3 years they were there. Everything pretty much that was edible or warmed your house or kept the country going, stripped away by the Germans. A lot of food, fuel, raw materials for industry were taken off to Germany. And Greece was absolutely in the most desperate, desperate state. Not helped by the fact that the Allies blockaded to stop supplies getting into Greece to make things harder for the Germans. So in a way, the Greeks doubly suffered. And it's a matter of interest. I know it interests everybody in this room, or all in your lives, been to an Oxfam shop. We've got lots of people don't know is that Oxfam was actually set up because of the Greek famine in 1941 and 42. I'm just going to show you, sorry, a very distressing photo, but that was a picture taken in the 1941-42 famine in Athens. And a group of academics in Oxford saw these photos and thought, we have to help. And they set up the famine relief organisation to get supplies into Greece to feed the starving. That's slightly on the side, but things were absolutely desperate in Greece, and quite quickly a resistance was organised against the Germans, a very strong resistance that collaborated with some of the special operations executive, who were of course British and marvellous, and they blew up bridges, and there were a lot of very successful acts of espionage against the Germans. But the other thing that happened during this period of the resistance was the resistance, maybe some people who know Greece well as I do will recognise that, but even the resistance became a bit divided, and there were the left-wing resistance and the right-wing. So even during the occupation there was some kind of antipathy, to put it mildly, between the two. Sometimes they acted together, sometimes separately. So all the while the occupation was in a state of occupation, there was this growing left-wing army, sort of army resistance organisation. And by the end of the occupation, when it actually all came to an end, the communists very much wanted to play a role in essentially what they hoped would be this new chapter of Greek history, where they were going to form their own government again. And they met fierce resistance. The British, Churchill, I always put it down to Churchill, and I know it's a terrible crime to say anything against Churchill at all, but he very forcefully said, do anything it takes to wipe out the communists, to get rid, Athens of the communists, because there were essentially communist troops coming into Athens. So the British sent troops, and there was a battle in the streets of Athens in December of 44, very, very fierce battle, lots of people died, and communists were sort of chased out. So that was the situation. One would sort of fondly hope that at the end of such a terrible three-year chapter, the idea of peace must have been on many people's minds. They must have thought, thank God, we can eat again, and breathe again, and walk down the street again. Instead, what they found, there was a new kind of battle happening on their streets in Athens. So into that sort of horrible black hole, I think it must have felt like a black hole, this sort of very febrile situation emerged, and not long after, a real civil war began.
Which is just, it's a lot of history that I'm not familiar with, and there's an awful lot of research that you've had to put together to find out all of this that happened in Greece. But you've got you've got great characters who are making that story come alive for us in your book. So can you tell us a little bit about how you found those characters, how you drew those characters to tell us this story that's quite a sweep of Greek history as well.
Yes, it actually begins in 1926 and sort of more or less goes on until 1989, where there was I won't give the story away, but a particular moment which kind of created or delivered for me the end of the tale. I told the story through the situation of the family, where there are two brothers and two sisters, and for most of their childhood, they're looked after by their grandmother, because their mother and father have disappeared for reasons that become clear when you read it. So we have these four siblings, and they're all quite strong characters, three of them, except for one of them, who is actually the protagonist. And Themis is, my sister has four children, which I always admired hugely. It just seemed like the most incredible number of people to sort of keep an eye on. And so I don't want to refer to him too much, but I have this wonderful nephew who was the fourth. That, I'm just thinking on my feet, Anne, maybe he inspired me. Roland was kind of not forgotten about, but he was always like, you know, small little one in the corner. And of course now he's this sort of fantastically, you know, achieving man. But at the time, he was always the one that you didn't quite notice as much as the other big personalities in the family. So we have Themis, she spends a lot of her early days either under the table, trying to get away from all the arguments that she, you know, sort of blocking her ears, or she's behind a curtain, or people have even forgotten where she is. Or where's Themis? You know, she's almost sort of left behind when they go out. In fact, she is left behind on one very particular day. So once that you've got these people in your mind, these sort of actually their children when we start off, then they sort of grow up like any other children. You know, they develop characteristics and things that kind of characterise them when they're little, like the older sister who's very sort of interested in clothes and only interested in herself. That becomes magnified. You know, I think that does sometimes happen as we grow up, that all our, sometimes our worst characteristics become the big ones. So we watch this family and the paths that their lives take, and in essence the way all of their lives are irrevocably altered and affected by the political situation. They're leading their own lives, but you know, going through the period of some great physical hardship during the occupation, the Civil War, and then the years after. They do make their own decisions, but every decision that they make is affected by outside influences. So I regard them as they're sort of normal people that who don't necessarily have control of their own destiny.
So we're finding out about this particular part of Greece and this time of Greece's history through this one family. But it is very much about a family being torn in two by the politics. What can we learn about that? Learn from that today. How do you feel about that? Writing about
again,
that.
Again, the only scenes that really reminded me of our situation is when they're arguing around the table. Because as I say, I sincerely don't believe that, you know, that the British will ever fight the British in the way that the Greeks fought the Greeks and killed each other in much greater numbers, and more people died during the Civil War than had during the occupation. For many Greeks, apart from the daily grind of finding food, I mean, they didn't experience violence from the Germans, most of them. But yes, when, you know, I have lots of people I know anyway, now don't speak to certain others because of the way that they feel about Brexit. You know, it is a very divisive issue. And we're all quite bored with it now, I think. I certainly am. I almost beginning to listen to Radio 2 when I was on today program. I thought it might be Jacob Rees-Mogg again. I don't know how to do it, do you? Frankly, I don't. That's enough of what it is. But yeah, just that sort of real, you know, table banging arguments. They're very familiar in our family. You know, our children have walked out of the room after a big tiff, but they're having their shots either me or my husband. I don't think we'll go that way.
But what about the Greeks? How do they view their recent history? How did you find that they look back on this time?
I think the period of the Civil War is still, I mean, it is 50 years ago, or more than that now, but they're nearly 70, isn't it? But it's still very raw for them, because there are still many people who were told about it by their parents, like the grandparents who are still alive, telling them what happened, or even the grandchildren who've heard sort of, you know, oral narratives about it, but they don't really have a version of it that is acceptable to everybody, because people who were against the communists still absolutely hate the communists, and there are communist MPs in their parliament. It's still a party with you know, plenty of representation, and at the same time, even though they have their far right, the Christiaki, the Golden Dawn, who preach, you know, very fascistic messages and have a symbol that's like the swastika, very hard to distinguish them. So, because it's still kind of rumbling around the place, they really prefer not to talk about it too much. Mm. And I've already encountered people who say, you know, why have you written about Mekhanisos? You know, very aggressively. They think it's a very bad thing that I'm sort of stirring up something that is part of a, you know, very dark and to some extent shameful. Because I'm sure, you know, anybody who does read about Mekhanisos, you know, has to acknowledge that terrible acts of torture were conducted there, and breaches of human rights, you know, beyond any European legislation. And you can't get away from that.
At the same time,
they've applied now, a group who are very interested in preserving Mekhanisos as a monument to kind of remind us of the consequences of such division in the country. They're applying for UNESCO World Heritage status for Mekhanisos as it is now. Which would be fantastic, because it's not just a place that says, oh, the communists were good and they were really badly treated. It's the whole situation that led to that, something that's sort of deeply and profoundly kind of undesirable and to be avoided. Can I just show some pictures of this island as it is now? Because I think it's... I'm just going to flick over. These are to do with Nazi atrocities. So I'm not going to dwell on those right now, because otherwise we'll get entrenched in them.
So how did you get over to the island in the first place, then, when it finally...
It's very difficult to get there, because nobody expects you to want to go there for a start, so nobody's thought of setting up a nice regular tourist boat. Mm-hmm. So, but there's nothing to stop you going. So I hired a rig. Everyone knows about boats in Woodbridge. A rigid inflatable boat, I think that means, isn't it? So it's like a, you know, speed boat, not very stable, but that was the only way that I could get across there. And I think three times I hired it all set up, ready to go, and then the waters between Mekhanisos and the mainland, usually go from Lavrio, are very, very rough. I mean, no one ever would have swum to escape. So the trip was cancelled, and it took me sort of from one summer to the next. So it was kind of felt like a really exciting day to actually finally get there. And you just step off the boat, there's nobody wanting €5 or anything at all, actually. You literally get off and you find yourself confronted by these sort of atmospheric and derelict buildings that were put up during the 1940s. And one of the most remarkable places is this kind of, it's like a sort of satirical version of Epidaurus, which I'm sure lots of people have been to, or the Odeon in Athens, which is these incredible open-air theatres which have extraordinary acoustics, and generally they're made with ancient marble, and you get these wonderful marble seats, but in Makronisos it was built out of concrete, and the front seats would have been taken by the army generals, and then the rest of the seats by the, what did they call them? They had various euphemisms. They generally weren't referred to as prisoners, they were the detainees, and they would be obliged to sit in the full glare of the sunlight and listen to propaganda to try and make them reform. And they built a cathedral, which not long afterwards is gradually decomposing. And perhaps the most exciting thing of all, that's me, that's not the most exciting thing of all here, this here, this amazing huge, I only left me in the photo so you could see the scale of the statue of the man who sort of is a memorial to all the people who were imprisoned there with the barbed wire around his legs and this boulder on his shoulder. It's one of the very standard ways of making these prisoners pass the day was to carry huge quantities of rock from one end of the island to the other for absolutely no purpose at all. It was an exercise in futility to try and grind their spirits down. And now there's a monument also to women who were kept there. So it's a very, very moving place, and it was an extraordinary, having sort of filled my head with so much about Makronisos and then to go, it was fulfillment of a strange ambitions that one has, but for me it was a really big ambition to get there, and I'm very much hoping that lots more people will go and just see this kind of desolation and imagine what it was like for those people.
But the you mentioned about the women who were kept there as well, and of course your central character Themis goes there, and we find out through her and her experience. How important was that strand in the story for you, about telling the women's suffering, if you like, there?
Yes, I wanted to describe, in a way, oddly, it was a period of liberation for women when they could join up and become a soldier. It was, for all of them, the first time they'd ever put on trousers, let alone pick up a gun, and they were communism treating everybody as an equal. Men and women were treated very equally and expected to perform exactly the same tasks. So in some sort of minuscule way, it was a sort of good thing for Greek women that they could step outside the domestic situation. And all of that obviously came grinding me to a halt at the end of the Civil War when they were back with their sort of dresses on and doing normal domestic things, or working in factories. A lot of women in those days did do manual labour. So Themis, it just seems natural to me always to tell things through the eyes of a woman. Not to say that I'm not interested in my male characters, but she is female, but she's not a sort of girly woman at all. She's a very strong person, and in fact her name can be used for men and women, as I sort of discovered. Her name actually means justice. Themis was the goddess of justice, and we see her in London on the top of the Old Bailey as a statue, and Themis is always blindfolded and holding scales. And that, to me, represented Themis quite well. Although I picked her name not really thinking too much about what it meant, but it, she seemed to grow into that. That's her burning ambitions to have justice.
And travelling through this story yourself, I mean, for one thing, it's quite harrowing in places. So how did it affect you as you were immersing yourself in the story to relive it through your characters? How did you feel about that?
I'm going to put people off when I tell them how harrowing it is. And I know my mother is finding it very harrowing, aren't she? Tough. It's a tough book. But my answer to anyone says, why have you written such a tough book? Is that I haven't actually made tough bits up. They're all there. You know, I think they all actually happened. I haven't made anything worse than it was in the actual real history. I haven't hardened anything up or exaggerated anything to shock. You know, the famine picture is absolutely real. The stories that I describe in the book of how the communists behaved, which was appalling as well, I mean, terrible atrocities. I haven't made up the Nazi atrocities, which I haven't kind of gone over, the pictures you saw briefly. There were some villages that were simply wiped out, burned down, and the inhabitants slaughtered. You know, that all happened. I didn't make anything up. The bits where I used my imagination or the acts of humanity, which I'm sure did happen, but they were my kind of fictional moments. And this probably sounds an awful thing to say, but I hope people like it. I hope people like it from the point of maybe learning something about Greek history that they didn't know before. I mean, that's always a good thing. I don't think anybody goes, oh, I wish I didn't know that. Perhaps they do, but I hope my readers don't. And I stopped by mentioning, you know, what was happening in the Civil War, but that wasn't the end of it. You know, as I say, this story goes on right up until the end of the 80s. And there were things that took place in the 1970s that, you know, had a terrible sort of tragedy. I mean, this particular tragedy in Greek history took place in 1973. It's all there in the book, and I'm not going to give it away, but I got very upset reading about it myself in order to write it. And then imagining, particularly from Themis's point of view, what it was like to go to actually experience those things, because it's very different reading, you know, I love Anthony Weaver, we all love Anthony Weaver. I'm grateful to him for bringing me so much history, but I can read that quite, in a way, with my head. You know, it only comes down to here. But then when I write, I have to use the heart bit, because I am imagining what it felt like to see or experience such things.
And we don't want to stress that it is... We don't want to stress too much how difficult it is to read, because it is a very beautiful book as well, and through the character of Themis, there is hope and there is fortitude and courage.
Honestly, I always think it's terrible to finish, particularly it is quite a long book, it's the longest book I've written, and to get through all that and then have a miserable ending, and I promise I haven't done that to you, because people do, you know, Anna Karenina, Head on the Line. That's a terrible moment, isn't it? But I have to give some hope and catharsis, I hope, and that's definitely there in the book. Because if there isn't that moment, for me, I wouldn't write it in the way that I wouldn't have written The Island if there wasn't a cure for leprosy. Well, I don't know. If there wasn't a cure for leprosy, I definitely wouldn't have embarked on that story. and similarly, with the thread, you know, there's hope for return. So I promise you won't be on the floor and think, oh, that's not worth living. You know, Yeah, I like the ending. Did you like the ending? Sorry, that's terrible. Sort of like, I particularly like the ending. So I thought it's all been worthwhile. This book actually, because there were moments when I was writing it, when I thought, I'm not sure the point of this, because it was grueling. It was one terrible thing after the other. And how do we lift this? How do we make sense of it, really? How do we make sense of the hatred that really existed in Greece between, you know, within families, between families, between villages even? Can I explain the title? Is that right? It's kind of the punchline to the book, but the title is a bit "Those Who Are Loved." Did anybody think, what does that mean? Who's loved? And it's a quote from a poem that was written by one of the great 20th century Greek poets, Yanis Ritsos. And Yanis Ritsos, in the 1936, so it goes back sort of right to the beginning period of the story I'm telling, Yanis Ritsos saw a photograph. I'll just actually quickly go forward to it, because that's me. Lots of pictures of me, like my holiday snaps. Me in Athens, me in Athens, me. That's my dream home. Oh, hang on. Here we are, that's the picture. It's very, very blurred, but it was even in the original. It's a photograph from a newspaper in 1936, and it shows a woman basically bowed in grief over her dead son. And what's happened is that he was one of the strikers, someone striking during tobacco strikes in Thessaloniki, and the police opened fire, and he was one of the young men killed. And Yanis Ritsos, who was very left-wing, would definitely supported the actions of the people on strike, was deeply moved by the photograph, and he wrote this huge epic poem called Epitaphios, and it's in the voice of the mother talking to her dead son about what's happened, and it ends to some extent on a sort of note of hope, where she essentially acknowledges that those who are loved never die. And it just seemed, after all this trouble and strife and turmoil and grief that I've been reading about, and then I found that poem, and I thought this sort of, because there is an element of forgiveness in this mother's, in her words, and I thought that just about makes sense, that, you know, if you're loved, whatever actions you've done, whatever things have happened in your life, you know, love is ultimately going to save you.
Mm. Okay, well, I have got quite a few more questions, but shall we open it up to your questions? Has anybody got anything that they'd like to ask? Victoria?
Yes, here.
If you could shout.
I keep seeing that disco ball, and just thinking, it would be fun if it was on.
Which is your favourite book?
My favourite book is this one. And I don't say that just because I've just finished it, but it kind of, each book I write contains more of what I know and
like
and dislike about Greece. So it kind of, yeah, it's like a snowball. I feel there's more in this one than in the others. And yeah, I would say this one contains heart, body, and soul. But whether everyone agrees, I don't know. You'll have to tell me.
Well, also, you might get a different response in Greece to the book from here. And also, Victoria speaks in Greek when she does events in Greece, which is, well, astonishing to do an event in a different language. But then to actually answer possible difficult questions.
I was saying that in Greece, people come usually with a very pressing ear. It's going to be someone who's going to fire a fearsome question, but quite often, because you know, I'm stepping into somebody else's territory, really, and you know, pulling up paving stones under which there might be something that's been hidden. And you know, I think the Greek did the same in this country and disturbed something that we didn't like to talk about. We'd probably be really angry and sort of, that's to say the least. So in Greece sometimes people give me a, you know, really quite a wide view of this book is going to be a big question. You know, what's it got to do with you? Mm. But still I'll answer that in my I'm confronted with it in October.
October, you're going there to do that. Right.
Okay, any other questions?
Yes.
Where do you write? And if you write in Greece, does it help you with the plot and what happens? And if you're back in the UK, does it make it more difficult because you can't soak up the atmosphere?
Great question, thank you. Where do I write and does it help being in Greece? I usually do all my research reading-wise here because I read everything in English. I don't yet read big Greek histories because my Greek's good enough to defend myself in Greek but not to kind of read it.
But didn't you read diaries in Greek?
Yes, I can read diaries. It's sort of easier.
But from the archives? So.
Yes, yeah. I've read some letters and diaries. But on the whole, research happens here. And I spent, for this book, particularly lots of time in Athens, because most of all, although I talked about the islands, the reason there was a picture of me standing on the balcony is that's where I have
an apartment.
Oh, a comment. I have an apartment in Athens, in the area where most of the book is set. And it's a very, I don't like to insult the area because I love it, but it's the opposite of posh. It's the opposite of Knightsbridge. It's, where would it be? Probably, I don't know, maybe Haringey. But I haven't been to Haringey for a while. I don't know. But it's somewhere that you're slightly afraid to walk at night, is where my place is. So when I'm there, then I really, that's where I wrote a lot of the parts about Athens, because I really felt it and smelt it and generally absorbed the atmosphere. And it does help to be in Greece, to write, to be immersed in a place that we're trying to describe. But having said that, I use a lot of photographs. I have thousands of pictures that I can look at and remind me of, you know, what the street corner is like, or the square, or what a typical cafe looks like. So it's a real mixture. But I couldn't just sit in London and write that sort of book, you know. I'm obliged. I just have to apologise to my family how much I'm away, but I think they'll get used to it. Mum often says, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm in England." "Oh." And the other option would be to be in Greece, because I do go back and forth a lot.
Anyone else?
No, not yet. And what about your language ability then? Because are you still getting lessons? And I mean, how are you improving, if you like, on learning Greek?
Gosh, I haven't had time for formal lessons for a couple of years now. But all my Greek friends are my teachers.
Yeah.
Because I say, don't speak in English, can we talk in Greek? So it just happens naturally, and I get free conversation lessons. And I listen to a lot of Greek music, so the lyrics of Greek songs are very helpful because you can kind of feel it's a different form of expression.
Yeah.
And there are quite a lot of good poetry books now that have parallel translations. So again, all that makes language learning a bit more interesting. And I watch Greek films without subtitles, and I can just about work out what's going on, because any dialogue tends to repeat, yeah. And you can, you know, see what people are doing. It's amazing. I can probably watch something in Chinese or Mandarin and know what's going on, but Greek films are very useful for that.
So you conduct your author visits in Greece in Greek. Do you do that in France as well? Do you speak French?
I do, yes.
And how do you find your audiences differ? I mean, it makes a difference being able to speak in their language, presumably, but how do they respond to you?
The surprise today is having so many men in my audience. Normally, my audience is even more predominantly female, so thank you for coming, chaps. And there's lots of war and battles, and for me, the second best character is a man here, who I'm most proud ever of any characters I've written of this Thanasis character.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm trying hard with my male protagonists. But in France, I would say even more predominantly female, and same in Greece. Yeah, so I know, at least I'm appealing to now 50% of men and some men. It's great to hear. Maybe I'm moving. Many men are. The men in this room, hello. Have you read my books? You have? That's good. I'm really pleased. Because I don't think they're just for women. I mean,
people often say, why
are you writing specifically for women? And I'm really not. I think it is just because my main character is often a woman that people assume.
I have read some of your books and enjoyed them enormously. Thank you very much indeed. My question is, to what extent do you think the Greeks have thrown off the memory of occupation by Turkey at the Ottoman Empire? And is it still affecting the way they speak and think?
Well, that's a very good question. Now, of course, the Turkish occupation was from the 15th century up to the 19th century, so that's a big long period. Many of them haven't thrown it off emotionally at all. You know, maybe intellectually, they know it's ridiculous to hark back to it, but I think they still sort of carry it around with them. And of course, right now, Erdogan doesn't entirely help, because every day there are these violations of airspace by the Turkish Air Force, and they count them, and some days there are dozens of them. So it's like a sort of cat and mouse game still. I don't really know what it means. You know, Turkey is so huge and their force is so enormous that the idea of Greece actually reacting and, you know, invading Turkey as they did in the 20th century is ridiculous. I don't think they would ever react. But diplomatically and politically, there's often some kind of spat going on. So yes, it's still, they still refer to it. And of course, the great sort of loss for them, and many of them still can't say the word Istanbul, they still say Constantinople. And one of the great moments of history that everyone in Greece knows is 1453, when the Ottomans took Constantinople from them. So, you know, it's not an open wound, but it's still there, and they still, you know, that was a crisis for them that they carry around with them. It's almost part of their DNA now, but I hope, again, that it's not going to be a matter of war. But as I say, the Turks fly there, planes into Greek airspace, you know, many, many times every week, and it just looks like they're doing it to say, you know, just to provoke.
Anybody else? Yes.
During the Civil War, you talked about Athens and maybe everything happened there. Was it also awful out in the countryside and well away from Athens?
Absolutely. It was worse in the north. In the mountains of the north.
Sorry, I just need to repeat the question. Sorry. It was the Civil War, and whether it affected people in the rural areas as much as the city.
Very, very much so, because the Battle of Athens, the sort of starting spark point, was in Athens, but then a lot of the fighting in the Civil War went on in the villages in the Peloponnese and right up in the north, and the final battles were fought in the mountains of Granos, which are far north as you can get. So it's affected pretty much the whole country, yeah.
Yes, front row.
I used to work in Greece in the 80s. Oh. I worked in Corfu, but there was
And Baileu was the big island, and the, not island, the mainland, that everyone, the Greeks, didn't like. It sort of didn't place for us. And they said, to understand, you know, our history, you need to watch the film Eleanor. And from there, and for me, that was the basis, and then this is all.
So I just wanted to say that because
there is that big story there about all the children going off to Albania.
Yeah, the lady here is referring, and it's a very good film,
it's electrifying, good.
A film called Eleni, based on the book by Nicholas Gage, and it's about his mother's, what happened in her village. And again, this is, some of this is reflected here on what happened in the village where Nicholas's mother lived, was that communist soldiers came in and they brutally killed a lot of the men, I think, and kidnapped children. And this really happened, and they were taken away and basically sent over into Albania and some into other countries that after that became part of the Soviet bloc, and many were never seen again. So it's a very big story, a very big aspect of Greek history. And then you'll see those threads in here. Because there's a big story surrounding children generally in that Civil War period. There were essentially the children that were taken away by the communists, up to about 28,000 of them, and they were looked after again. You hear very kind of disturbing things about how they were looked after or abandoned. They were considered by the communists to be these young minds that needed to be protected from this sort of right-wing alternative that was going to be the next state of Greece. So they wanted these children to grow up as communists. And some of them were the children of the communists, so they thought, well, we're not going to be able to bring them up in Greece and know that they'll be allowed to follow this path, so we'll send them to Albania, Romania, Yugoslavia, as it was. And some of them ended up in places as far as Tashkent in the Soviet Union. So that's one big communist children's story. And then the other aspect of the kind of children's fate of many children was that they were taken, if you were a communist and captured, your children were taken from you by the government and put into a children's home, a pedopoli, which is a chain of well-meaning children's homes set up by the Queen of Greece, Frederica. And these places were, you know, they looked after the children well, but they were taught to be, you know, good Greeks, i.e. to, you know the words of the national anthem and to be more on the sort of monarchist right-wing side. So you have these two big stories about children. People feel very strongly, again, you know, story of Eleni, which is a film, it's obviously very anti the communist way of dealing with children. And then there's a third strand, which is just emerging now, that many children were sent to America. And this has been, it's only just been kind of researched and discovered now that there were children that were more or less, I think they were sold. There was a certain money that changed hands, and they were adopted by families in America. So, yeah, children are very much the vulnerable victims of these stories.
Couple more questions? Yes.
Once you start writing, then you're quite strict and regimented, and then once you finish the book as this, do you feel you have to have some time just to regroup?
Lily asked whether I'm disciplined. I'm quite disciplined about the writing. I always start at the same time each day. I don't wait to feel I'm doing it. That's always, for me, a disaster. And I'll just have an old coffee or go for a walk. No, I just make myself start at the same time every day. And I usually, it probably sounds very slavish, but I like to know that I've written a certain number of words a day, even if I then cut them back the next day. I look at the word count, which is a terrible admission and doesn't sound very creative, but it's a way of knowing that you're moving forward. And there's never much of a gap between finishing it and then it coming out and talking about it, which I don't really mind, because otherwise I have been quite often when I do, a presentation in another country where they're maybe two books behind in what they've translated and published. I had this sort of terrible moment a year or so ago in France when they just published The Return, which very confusingly they called The Last Dance, which was the same name as a collection of short stories. And people in the audience were asking me about various characters, and I had absolutely no idea what they were talking about. You know, they're gone, really. I think there was the Ignacio, and I do remember the names now, so I had to kind of reread it afterwards. But I'm so caught up in this one that I don't mind moving from writing it to sort of sharing it and having opportunity to meet people like today, where while it's still fresh. I came in 2 years, they're missing she.
Okay, one last question. Yes.
I do.
What's next?
The next one, which I just started thinking about, I haven't put anything on paper, but it's surprisingly it's going to be in Greece again. Why stop now, really? And I did enjoy writing about Spain, but Greece somehow caught my imagination even more. It would be set in the Cycladic Islands, which are, as everybody knows, it's basically all the islands that we all go to, pretty much, are Cycladic. And there's a very interesting story there surrounding the archaeological treasures that have been found there. So I'm working on that at the moment.
And so you're now going to go on to other bookshops and festival
shops
to continue your tour, which carries on for how long?
Until the end of June.
End of June.
It's the end of next month.
Pretty constant until then, though. It's quite a lot packed in, isn't it? And then you have a break, and then you're doing focusing in October in Greece, is that right?
Yes, Greece and France and Norway.
Right. But you're not speaking Norwegian, then?
No, I don't speak Norwegian. But actually, the Norwegians speak English better than I do, so they're extraordinary, the Norwegians. Yeah. You know, they really do just talk and understand everything perfectly in English, because I found it very difficult to be to have that block between you and the audience where you're saying something and you think there's a big sort of blur in
the translation.
So I don't like being translated, which is why I learned Greek in the first place, because I wanted to express anything I wanted to say without needing somebody in the middle here.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad we haven't had anybody in the middle here today. It's been lovely hearing from you and hearing all the process that's been involved in getting this book together. And I'm sure you're all going to enjoy it and also be challenged by it and learn a great deal from reading it. You can now queue patiently to get the book signed by Victoria and have a few words with her one-to-one as well. So I hope you won't rush off. But do join me in thanking Victoria for joining us today.